Inflation fears grow in China.
And officials respond with higher interest rates for the third time this year.
From APM, American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Wednesday, July 6th.
Coming up, what does inflation in China mean for the economy here in the U.S.?
A little later, Facebook says it's announcing something awesome today. We'll tell you why that's an awesome marketing tactic.
And what does the width of your face say about the truth of your words? A lot, as it turns out, Steve.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The central bank in China raised interest rates this morning for the third time this year to cool inflation. Why does that matter to us? Well, let's ask Richard DeKayser, an economist with the Parthenon Group, who is with us from Boston, as he is every Wednesday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Richard, should Americans be concerned about rising inflation in China?
I don't think they should be concerned from the perspective of it causing inflation here. And let me explain why. Everything we import, all the goods and services that come into this country, only account for about 17% of our economy. And if you look at the Chinese share of that, it's less than a fifth. So a little arithmetic tells us that Chinese imports are only about even less than 3% of the U.S. economy, and the prospect of that creating broader inflation here just doesn't seem probable.
And what about inflation as a sign of an economy that is overheating? Do you think that there's a bubble in China that's about to burst?
Well, that's the bigger question, not so much inflation, but how China's managing its business cycle and whether it's able to get a soft landing, that is to say a gradual deceleration of growth with lower inflation, or a pop. But I think there is evidence that it's overheating. Inflation's gone from roughly 2% a year ago to 5.5% now. And even if you net out commodity prices, it's definitely on the rise.
Well, if you think that the Chinese are trying to have a soft landing here, aren't they doing just the right thing by raising interest rates to try to cool this inflation?
I think they are. You know, a decade ago, economic policymakers thought the best way to look at bubbles was to simply wait for them to occur, because identifying them so hard and then deal with them after the fact. But the disposition now is to try and be a little bit more proactive. That's what the Chinese are doing. I think it does make sense.
Richard DeKayser, economist with the Parthenon Group. Thanks as always.
My pleasure. Take care.
Well, Jeremy, Richard, the FDIC is expected today to finalize a proposal that would ask for a large chunk of big bank executive pay to be paid back if that CEO's bank fails. A lot of folks, though, in the banking industry say the so-called clawbacks plan goes a bit too far. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is with us. He has the latest on that story. Good morning, Mitchell.
Hi, Steve.
Exactly what does the clawback rule say?
Well, it's part of Dodd-Frank financial reform passed last year. Now, keep in mind, the goal here is to try and make sure that top executives pay the consequences when their firms endanger the rest of us. So we're talking the biggest banks like Goldman Sachs, JPMorgan Chase. These are the ones that, if they collapsed, would pose a systemic risk to the financial system. The CEO and CFO and chairman of the board could have their whole pay and bonus package going back 2 years clawed back by bank regulators if those regulators have to take over and then liquidate the company.
Why do these banks and their lobbyists think that that's a bad idea?
Well, they say it's too vague. How are regulators going to know if a CEO's the one at fault if the company got in trouble? You know, maybe it's just a bad market for mortgages or derivatives or whatever they're investing in. Scott Talbot is with the Financial Services Roundtable, and that represents big banks.
It could lead an executive who sees a company starting to get into trouble for whatever reason to simply leave and walk away before the company fails, thus excluding him or herself from the rule.
You know, and then they get to keep their multi-million dollar pay packages. Affirming these clawback rules could be one of the last actions of FDIC Chair Sheila Bair, by the way. She steps down on Friday.
All right, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reporting. Mitchell, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, let's not forget, it is Jobs Week here in Economy Land.
On Friday, we're going to get the big June employment report from the Labor Department, which will tell us how many jobs were added last month and what the new unemployment rate is. And just this morning, we got a look at the employment picture so far from the job placement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas. That company says the number of announced job cuts ticked up slightly last month, but over the last 6 months, the number of planned layoffs reached the lowest level since the year 2000.
We're joined now from Chicago by the firm's CEO, John Challenger. John, good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So, John, the lowest level of cuts since 2000, but is that going to be good enough to get the job market out of the ditch it's in?
We need really the next leg in this turnaround, and that's job creation. Companies aren't laying off many people, although there's been a little bit of extra layoffs now just lately with a pause in the economy. But we need companies to start creating jobs to see unemployment drop.
And I know that one of the big factors over the last several months has been the Japanese earthquake. Is that still a factor in jobs here in this country?
Doesn't seem to be. The components and the supply chain out there in Japan might have slowed down manufacturing, but that's not the case. Manufacturing seems to be doing pretty well. It's really now more concerns about debt, whether it's European debt or the debt ceiling here in the U.S.
And in your report this morning, any sectors of the economy that are doing particularly well?
Yeah, the tech sector, energy are showing growth in addition to the healthcare sector. We're also starting to see seasonal growth in retail and entertainment leisure.
John Challenger, CEO of Challenger Gray and Christmas, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
ExxonMobil said today a discrepancy over how long it took to plug that leaking pipeline in Montana's Yellowstone River. The oil spill has raised a lot of questions about pipeline safety. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Eve Troh reports.
Pipeline spills are different than offshore oil spills. The Department of Transportation oversees pipelines. It requires a worst-case safety plan for each one, but
all the dry runs or drills in the world aren't going to be really effective if they don't apply to the case that you actually experience.
Richard Kupervitz consults energy companies on risk. He says Exxon seems not to have accounted for heavy late spring snow in Montana. That's now melting and has the Yellowstone River rushing and flooding its banks.
We're finding too many incidences where the oil spill response plans are not really effective because they didn't really address a worst-case scenario.
Prevention should be the focus, says Mike Levine at the nonprofit Oceana. Even the best cleanup plan won't get out all the crude.
We simply can't. There's going to be a lot of oil left in the ocean or in the river.
Likely 90% of what's spilled, he says. Exxon shut down the pipeline in May over fears a fast current could damage it, but then decided the risk wasn't that high. I'm Eve Troh for Marketplace.
Well, if you're looking for the numbers from Wall Street or other stories we've been following, check out marketplace.org.
You can also find us on Twitter. I'm at Radio Geo.
And I am at Jeremy Hobson.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. Today, the British Parliament holds an emergency 3-hour debate on accusations that employees of the newspaper News of the World hacked into people's cell phones. Global media titan Rupert Murdoch owns that paper. He also, of course, owns the Wall Street Journal and Fox Television here in the U.S. and a whole host of other media properties around the world, from Canada to his homeland of Australia. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London to walk us through this very complicated story. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
Talk about this phone hacking. What exactly is phone hacking?
It's calling someone's cell phone, getting their password and listening to their messages. And it's alleged that News of the World did this to the cell phone of a missing 13-year-old girl who it later turned out had been murdered. News of the World hacked into her phone so they could report on the case. And it's alleged they actually deleted some messages on her phone to make room for more. This has caused a wave of revulsion here because this gave the parents the false hope that their daughter might still be alive. And there have now been numerous other allegations suggesting phone hacking on an industrial scale by the News of the World.
What impact, Stephen, is this having on Murdoch and his dominance in the newspaper business there?
Well, this is an immensely powerful media group. It's got 40% of the British press. It runs the country's biggest commercial TV broadcaster. The problem is the editor at the News of the World at the time of the most damaging alleged incident was Rebecca Brooks, who is now the head of News International and one of Murdoch's most trusted executives. There have been widespread calls for her to resign. Simon Greenberg of News International says Rebecca Brooks won't resign, but she has launched a full internal inquiry.
She's absolutely determined to get to the bottom of this issue. We are under no illusion that she is absolutely determined that if things went wrong, that we will correct them and that that justice will be done.
There are likely to be renewed calls for her head, however, during today's parliamentary debate on the issue. A very tricky subject, this, for both the government and the opposition. Both main parties have cozied up to Rupert Murdoch because it's claimed they feel they need his newspaper's support if they want to get elected.
So a balancing act there, Stephen. Any kind of financial damages yet?
Yes, Ford has said it will no longer advertise in the News of the World. A number of other big advertisers say they are, quote, reviewing the situation. And there's a campaign underway on Twitter and Facebook urging all advertisers to boycott the paper.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard. An interesting story reporting from London this morning. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
Well, Steve, from your last name, Chiatakis, I know it's a country you're very close to,
yes.
Greece, but but forget it this morning. You're not the center of attention for once.
Oh, thank goodness. My goodness.
When it comes to the European debt crisis, the focus is on Portugal today. Mm. That country had its debt rating downgraded to junk last night by Moody's, which said Portugal may need a second bailout. For more, let's bring in Fernando Alexander, an economist at the University of Minho in Portugal. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how does the Portuguese debt crisis differ from the one in Greece, or is it just basically same story, different country?
In a sense, we are similar to the Greece economy because we have a debt problem. I think the main difference currently is that the Portuguese people, they support the agreement that the Portuguese government settled with IMF and the European Union. The Portuguese people is prepared to accept that we'll try to solve the problem of the public deficit and also the problem of the over-indebtedness of the Portuguese economy.
So the Portuguese people may be more ready to make some big drastic cuts. But do you think that this debt crisis is moving faster than officials can keep up with it?
It's true that without the external funding coming from the IMF and the European Union, the Portuguese economy could not comply with its obligations in financial markets. So it's true that the European Union needs to find probably new solutions to the Greek problem and also to the Portuguese economy.
Fernando Alexander, an economist at the University of Minho in Portugal. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
A judge in Detroit, Jeremy, is expected to rule on a dispute involving the Ambassador Bridge. That's the privately owned span that connects Detroit to Windsor, Ontario, in Canada. You've probably seen it in the pictures before. Maybe you've crossed it a few times.
I've never crossed it, but
it is the busiest. I did not know this before today. The busiest international trade crossing in North America.
Hmm.
And the two-year-old case highlights a big clash between the private sector and the federal government. Reporter Sarah Hewlett has more.
On a recent day in Detroit, motorist Jessica Irvine has just wound her way past orange barrels and temporary signs to duty-free gas pumps at the foot of the Ambassador Bridge.
It's kind of confusing. It's a little bit of a mess right now.
The mess inside the plaza is the result, in part, of a dispute between the company that owns the bridge and the state. One of the issues is the bank of gas pumps where Irvine is fueling up. Tony Cratifil is an engineer for the Michigan Department of Transportation. He says the bridge company ignored plans that would have routed traffic past its lucrative duty-free store and gas station. Instead, travelers like Irvine are directed right through it.
You could see where if there was a lot of traffic, say on a holiday weekend or something, you got people backed up in there waiting to get gas, it's going to interfere with the flow of traffic trying to get back to the freeway.
The state and the bridge company are each responsible for a share of a $230 million construction project, which is meant to better connect the bridge and the interstate freeways on the Michigan side. The state sued the bridge company in 2009 to force it to comply with the design the two sides agreed to. A judge ruled in the state's favor, and in January, the bridge company's president was briefly held in jail for refusing to comply with the judge's order. Now, nearly half a year later, the state's asking for fines of $100,000 a day until the bridge company complies. Company officials declined an interview request, but its president, Dan Stamper, told reporters last month he's ready to put the litigation behind him.
Even though we disagree with MDOT on some of the aspects of the project, we'll complete our construction before January 12, 2012, as ordered by the court.
Stamper says the company is moving toll booths that were not in compliance with the plan and is deeding over land the state needs to complete a ramp. He'll find out tomorrow whether that's enough to satisfy a judge who's presided over 2 years of hearings on the company's noncompliance. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace.
Researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee studied a group of nearly 200 business students, Jeremy, and how ready each was to lie or cheat to gain a competitive advantage. I mean, you know, we're in the radio business, right? We see it every day, don't we?
Yeah, of course.
The study found men with wider faces were 3 times more likely to lie and 9 times more likely to cheat to get ahead. The researchers say the wider a man's face, I think it's width to height ratio is what they're calling it. The wider his face, the more powerful he feels he is. And with that power, they say, comes aggressive, self-interested behavior.
So they assume that the wider the face is, the more powerful that he thinks he is, and therefore the more likely he is to lie. So powerful people are more likely to lie.
Powerful people, they have more self-confidence, and they figure they can get away with it. There are all kinds of theories that revolve around this. But the study also stresses that men with wide faces can also channel those unethical tendencies to be more constructive and successful. So they don't have to lie. They can do it without lying or cheating. They can just become successful and find other ways to become successful. Something awesome, Jeremy, is expected to be announced today. That's according to Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Aren't you excited about this awesome announcement?
I can't wait. In fact, by the way, because this is a podcast, I bet by the time that people actually listen to this,
the awesomeness
will already have transpired.
Zuckerberg, by the way, told reporters last week that the company is going to unveil this awesomeness today. And announcing an announcement might seem like a step too many, but Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports it works pretty well as a business tactic.
The media has exploded with speculation about Facebook's announcement. Is it a Skype feature? Is it an iPad app? Here's tech analyst Rob Enderle.
Facebook is stealing a page from Apple, trying to build a feeding frenzy surrounding what it is they're going to announce tomorrow.
And the timing is no accident, says Brad McCarty, editor at The Next Web. He points out that Google's social networking site Google Plus was just unveiled.
Right now, Google Plus is kind of tromping all over the news. And so Facebook immediately shot back and said, oh, yeah, by the way, we're doing something really awesome.
It's also an intimidation tactic, says McCarty. He says when companies like Google and Facebook make an announcement, the entire industry listens. Making everyone wait just emphasizes that point.
You're talking about the category killers. These are essentially the Walmarts of the digital space. And they can go into any area and essentially wipe out anything else.
There is a risk to all the hype, says McCarty. If the announcement is underwhelming, you can expect a backlash that matches the buzz. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Well, supermarkets around the country are responding to the latest threat to their business, which is extreme couponing.
Mm.
It means exactly what you think, rampant coupon use by people who try to make a lifestyle out of saving 50% on this and $2 on that, or maybe more. So far, Rite Aid, Kroger's, Publix, and Target have joined in the crackdown by, in some cases, limiting the number of coupons that people can use. For more on this coupon craze, let's turn to LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, David, is this for real? Coupons are really being used a lot right now?
Oh, yeah. In fact, in 2009, and that's the latest year for which the people who crunch these kinds of numbers have been looking at the data, we saw a 29% increase in coupon use.
Wow.
What that means is 3.3 billion coupons being redeemed for merchandise goods, equivalent to nearly $1 billion in savings. So that's a whole lot. And clearly indicative of people being concerned about the economic downturn.
And is this something we see in every economic downturn or just this one?
No, it looks like this is a regular thing, that when the economy goes sour, people go to coupons. But in this current downturn, coupon use is much lower than we saw in 1992, the last time we really hit a speed bump with the economy, when nearly 8 billion coupons were redeemed. And I've been trying to figure that out. I'm guessing it's a generational shift, and the current folk out there making up the consuming public just aren't as old school about coupons as others.
And are people using coupons that you clip out in newspapers, or are we talking about Groupon and Living Social, these online coupon sites?
We're talking the vast majority are still newspaper ones. In fact, the online coupons account for maybe about 1% of coupon use these days, so it's still just a smidge, but that's where all the growth is. Online coupons are growing exponentially, which is why companies like Google are piling into that.
All right, time to save money, David. Do coupons really work? Are these people who are using coupons in this downturn saving real money?
Yeah, they really do work. And the so-called extreme couponers out there can really save big bucks, you know, maybe $1,000 a month off of their bills, 50% perhaps. But that's a whole lifestyle. You've got to be utterly dedicated and obsessive about your coupons, even to the point of stealing newspapers from your neighbor's yard. That's pretty intense. I'd say for most people, you're going to get savings of 10, 20%. But remember this, the vast majority of coupons, especially for food, are for processed foods. So if you get big into coupons, you're not going to be eating really healthy.
LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
And Jeremy, I want to chime in with you about the debate over coupons.
Yeah.
All right? Is it coupons or coupons?
I've always heard coupons. I know some people say coupons, but I would think that would be like if it was Cupid, C-U-P-I-D.
It would have to be C-U, yeah, because I've always said it coupons. Now, I grew up in the South, all right? I was born in Indiana but grew up in Alabama, and I always said coupons. My family always said coupons. I came to California and everybody was like, coupons? What the heck's a coupon? It's a coupon.
You know. By the way, Steve, what I will never get. I'm here in New York this week, and the people here say in line. They say we're standing online for this.
Online.
I'm standing online for this bagel. I'm standing instead of standing in line. I've never understood that.
I love regionalism. I love the differences in the way people talk and the way you know their expressions and all kinds of things.
That's absolutely. Great. And here's we're going to go now to a place that has a great regional accent, New Zealand.
Yeah.
Where a couple got trapped in a hotel room during the earthquake that happened back there in February. And though they did manage to escape the wreckage after breaking down doors and crawling onto a roof, they did not escape the charges on their hotel bill, Steve.
Oh, my goodness.
Including about $15 a day for parking, even though they weren't able to retrieve their car from the crumbled parking garage for 2 months.
Ooh.
Good news, though. After this story made the New Zealand press, the hotel decided to waive the charges.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. Lest there be bad PR in that.
That wouldn't have been good for business at all. Yeah, that wouldn't have been very awesome in the words of Mark Zuckerberg. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.